one day late, of course. Thank those people participating in this program. I have to say that, of course, Chang Feng and Nassif, who I let them decide small things like whom to invite, who does what, and so on and so forth. And I got to decide important things like what the weather is going to be today, when to declare war to Russia, and those things. Anyway, it's a pleasure. I want to continue what we talked about yesterday. Let me just backtrack a little bit on there. Maybe I can turn off the... Just this one.
We'll try this.
No, that's not quite.
It's here.
Oh, okay.
It's there.
Okay, good.
Yeah. I don't know which is which. Have to try it.
That must be a lecture. No? Yeah, good. Thanks. All right, so yesterday we said that with the example on the Latka Volterra competition system, you see, even my laser pointer works today, so it's also on Tibetan time. Anyway, so for the weak competition, there's nothing interesting. Everything goes to a constant. And then we looked at a cross-diffusion system we did, proposed by three Japanese mathematicians or theoretical biologists. And we talked about the background of the system a little bit, so on and so forth. So I thought I would also talk a little bit about the earlier work on this one. So the first set of work was due to Mimura, Nishiura, Tesei, and Tsujikawa on transition layer steady states of this system. So they are looking at the steady state, so there's no time dependence. And you see that we drop everything, all the coefficients, all the rho ij's except rho 1,2. That goes there. And d2 is epsilon squared. So what they did, what they showed, was that under certain circumstances, this is, by the way, a special case for the strong competition. So they say that for epsilon small, d1 large, and rho 1,2 over d1 large, this problem has transition layer solutions that will look like this one. It turns out that, of course, the order is very important. When I say, I put a dagger mark there for this phrase, and that's the explanation is here. The order is important. So what they do is they fix rho 1,2 over d1, fix it to be large, and then let epsilon go to 0. And solve this problem for epsilon equals 0, and for large d1, then return from epsilon 0 to epsilon positive, but small. So it's a singular perturbation problem. And let me just write this down carefully a little bit here. So this is what they did. So they set W to be that, what's inside the parentheses or the bracket, and let epsilon go to 0 formally. Then the second equation becomes this one, an algebraic equation. So, and they pick solutions of this kind. Of course, there are many. This is just a very, very rough sketch. This is a very technical thing. I guess, I don't know for sure because I wasn't here last week, but if you were here last week, I suppose somebody talked about things like this last week. You know, how to smooth that out and so on. This is what they do anyway, phase transition and stuff like that. So epsilon goes to 0, they they pick a solution V0 discontinuous. Of course, the point of discontinuity, the choice is an important one. I'm not saying anything here about that. So this needs justifications. All right. So I want to compare this approach to a slightly different approach. That is to say, instead of let epsilon go to zero, you first, under the same setting, you let the d1 go to infinity first. So what happens when d1 go to infinity? So if we let d1 go to infinity first, w will go to a constant zeta. Then this problem becomes this one. So the first equation becomes an integral constraint, and the second equation remains. So this is a shadow system. So I like to compare this one to compare these two systems, that system and this system. I will return to this one later. But anyway, so this is roughly how the transition layer comes about. And all right. So I will not explain how to pick the point of discontinuity here. That's probably talked about a number of times during last week's workshop. Okay. So next thing I want to do is to say, well, in this approach, we fixed rho 1, 2 over d1. So we fixed rho 1, 2 over d1. But what I would like to do is really to concentrate on the case that with all the parameters fixed, but let rho 1, 2 go to infinity and see what happens. So that's what we're going to do next. So with all the parameters fixed, let rho 1, 2 go to infinity. Okay. So the goal is to... So this is the equation, and our goal is to understand the effect of cross diffusion and the interplay between diffusion and cross diffusion and the qualitative behavior of steady states created in these considerations. What I'm going to talk about mostly will be joint work with Yuan Lo. We got this started, and Yutsutani joined us a little bit later. Okay. So the first thing is that I would like to get rid of some of the coefficients up there, rho 1, rho ijs. So the first thing I want to do is to get rid of the self-diffusion. The rho 1, 1, rho 2, 2 are self-diffusion coefficients, and rho 1, 2, rho 2, 1 are cross-diffusions. So this is the theorem. First, there is a constant k, independent, of course, independent of the self-diffusion coefficients. And if either one of the self-diffusion is large enough, then the system will not have a non-trivial steady state. So all these things depends on a priori estimates. But I will not talk about a proof of this one. Okay. So under that assumption, so if rho 1, 1, rho 2, 2 are large enough, we don't have any non-constant steady states. So what we're going to do now is to drop those rho 1, 1, rho 2, 2, and maybe drop one of the cross diffusion as well to make life a little bit easier. So what we're going to do now is to assume rho 1, 1, rho 2, 2, and rho 2, 1 are zero for simplicity. Just let one of the cross diffusion coefficients stay, and the rest is the same as before. So where is that? Yeah, it's here. All right, so this is for the comparison. So that's the difference. The only difference is just one coefficient up there. Okay, we are still in the weak competition case. This is a special case in the weak competition. And for technical reasons, I want to denote the eigenvalues of negative Laplacian by lambda k's and with multiplicity mk under zero Neumann boundary condition. Then the theorem says that if any one of the mk is odd, now this is probably a technical condition, I cannot do without, I feel bad about that of course, but anyway, the conclusion is that for the weak competition case, if any one of the mk is odd, then there are positive constants k1 k2 such that for all k1 positive, sorry, for all d1 positive and d2 in k1 k2, this system up here will have at least one non-constant solution if rho 1 2 is large enough. Okay, the k3 depends on aibi ci and d1 only. So if rho 1 2 is large enough, then D2, and D2 stays in the appropriate range, then the system will have a solution. So that shows that, not quite. Well, there's some contrast between these two things, between the cross diffusion system and the case where just you have diffusion. So, if rho 1 2 is not large enough, it's not large, then again U star V star is the only positive solution. U star V star is this one before. So if any of the three quantities, that is rho 1 2 over d1, or rho 1 2 versus d2, or rho 1 2 versus d1 over d2, the square root of d1 over d2 is small, then we are still back in the original case. So this shows some relations between the cross diffusion and diffusion. There are similar theorems for the strong competition case, which I'm not going to talk about, just to save some time to talk about something else. But I do want to say one thing, that is, I do want to make one more remark on this condition. That is, D2 has to belong to a certain range. How necessary is that? Well, there's a theorem here shows that it is important to have that. Well, in both weak and strong cases, we are only talking about the weak case. We're not talking about a strong case anyway. So D2 is required to stay in some appropriate range for existence. This turns out to be crucial. So here's the theorem. It says that if dimension is less than or equal to 3, then certainly includes the weak case, right? Then for fixed AIBI CI, there's a K depending on AIBI CI, independent of D1 and rho 1 2. Such that if D2 is large enough, it's bigger than this K, then this system will have no non-constant solution. No matter what rho 1 2, no matter how large rho 1 2 becomes. So this is very consistent with our daily life, of course. We say that behind every successful woman, there's a great man. So rho 1 2 is the successful woman, of course, and D2 is this great man. And if this D2 moves around too much, running around too much, nothing is going to get accomplished. So anyway, now proof. Let's talk about the proof just a little bit. The proof is complicated. The proofs are complicated. But let's just mention it a little bit. Just touch upon it. The most important thing is to get a priori estimates independent of certain parameters depending on your choices, depending on your purposes. For instance, for the proof of non-existence, a priori estimates of this kind turns out to be helpful. You see, there's rho 1 2 over d1, there's rho 1 2 over d2, so here I have rho 1 2 over d1, here I have rho 1 2, well, rho 2 1, but that's 0, so that's okay. Anyway, so Once we have that, we can do various things to apply our previously existed methods. For instance, the Lyapunov functional method we talked about for the weak case, certainly. So we just transform this problem to this one and then apply the Lyapunov functional to this new system. Okay. With the a priori estimates there, this method goes through easily. So that's the non-existence. It's pretty. Once you have a priori estimates, it's not so hard. For the existence, it's a degree theoretic argument. And again, the a priori estimates are important. But the a priori estimates here are a little more complicated. Okay, so there are some technical conditions up there. Anyway, it's less, the a priori estimates here are less explicit than before. Anyway, so one uses a degree theoretic argument to push it through. And of course, most people here are familiar with degree theoretic arguments, and that's where does this MK being odd for some K bigger than or equal to 1 comes in. That's when you compute the index of the zero of the trivial solution to the system. If any one of them is odd, say MK is odd, then I just sum this up to L from 1 to K. Since only K is odd, the first K odd, then the previous one are even, then sigma is odd. Then this becomes negative 1. So that's where the technical thing comes in. That's why I said this is probably a technical condition, but we cannot get rid of it at this point. So this is sort of to say the existence theorems. Now, all right, so now let's talk a little bit about the qualitative behavior of solutions. Degree theoretic argument gives us a solution, but we don't know. That's a topological argument. We don't know what the solution looks like. So this one will tell us a little more about the solution. Actually, this is a classification theorem. This basically says that if n is less than or equal to 3, and of course this certainly includes the weak competition case, then if uj, vj is a non-constant solution of this system with rho 1, 2 going off, rho 1, 2, j going off to infinity, then either 1 or 2 must happen. 1 is that so 1 or 2 depends on basically the behavior of vj. If vj goes to 0, we are in 2. If Vj does not go to 0, we are in 1. That's all. I mean, the supernorm of Vj. So suppose Vj does not go to 0, then we are in 1. Then Uj, Vj goes to zeta over W and W uniformly, where zeta and W are solutions of this shadow system. All right. This comes from that. By letting rho 1, 2 go to infinity. First, you divide through by rho 1, 2. Well, sorry. This one comes from, the equation comes from the second equation here, and the integral constraint comes from the first equation by dividing through rho 1, 2. Now, if Vj goes to 0, then we can multiply Vj by rho 1, 2, j. Because rho 1, 2, j goes to infinity. Then this one does not go to 0 anymore. So uj and this one will go to uv, which will be a solution of this one. So you may think that, well, this may look a little simpler than the original system. This certainly doesn't look that much simpler. But turns out it is simpler. We are able to construct solutions to these systems. So I just want to construct some solutions to the systems. All right. So a typical solution of one will look like, I shouldn't say a typical solution of one, one solution, let's say. There are two kinds of solution to one. Now we know. One of them is this one. So this is V, the blue one is V. Well, I guess I'm not doing that very well here. So that's W. W is the blue one, and U is the zeta over W. The red one is zeta over W, this one. All right? And for two, similar. So we get two kinds of solutions from one and two. From one, we can construct one look like this one that is close to the original constant solutions, U star and V star, except maybe at some small narrow regions. Doesn't have to be a single point. It could be, if you do the reflections, you get many such solutions. Okay, both known to occur. The rest, just ignore the rest about questions about stabilities and so on. I will come to that later. Okay. So, let me just say one thing. I will come back to the system a little bit later, also, to discuss this one in a little more detailed fashion.
Can they both occur at the same parameter value?
Say that again?
Can you have both sorts of solutions occurring at the same parameter value?
Can I have both 1 and 2 occurring in the same parameter values?
Yes.
I don't remember. I don't know. Pardon?
Post-jump competition, yes.
I cannot hear you, sorry.
Post-jump competition, yes.
For strong competition, yes. Sorry. When did we prove that? Where? I don't remember.
Combine our first and two, first and second papers. I checked it.
Well, now you know who did what. I didn't do anything. All right. But I don't remember. I still don't. Sorry. But I remember we looked into that, but I don't remember if for the same parameter values. Okay. Anyway, I want to elaborate on this one a little bit more. That is, what really matters is not really rho 1, 2 going off to infinity, but rather rho 1, 2 over d1 going off to infinity. What happens there? That actually matters more. So as rho 1, 2 over d1 going off to infinity, of course, this case is more general than this one. So with this one, we have a few more cases. First, if this one going off to infinity and d1 goes to a finite value, this is essentially the previous case. So we have 1 or 2. That's 1, this is 2. Now, if rho 1, 2 over d1 goes off to infinity and d1 also goes off to infinity, then we have either 1 or 2 prime. 2 prime is this one. The classification is still clear, in the sense that the principle is still clear. That is, the rho vj in 2 prime still goes to 0. Okay? That's why we multiply that by this large quantity, we'll go to a constant. We'll go to a solution. We'll go to a function v. That's the second case. The third case says rho 1, 2 over d1 goes to a finite value. Well, then that means both go to infinity. In that case, this is 3. So this is the outcome. Well, as I said earlier when we talked about the transition layer case, this seems to indicate that, let me take this one off. I just want to concentrate on 3 here. Here I said a few more things on the first remark, but let's ignore that. Let's go to the second one. As R varies in 3, solutions are expected to exhibit various behavior, including transition layer and spike layers. Okay. That is, if we write 3, this equation, in this form, then if we plot the nonlinearity, the nonlinear term that's plotted here. R is infinity, that's the first one, and then R is large, that's the red one. R is zero, that's the blue one. Okay, when I say the solutions are expected to exhibit various behavior, meaning I cannot prove, we don't have a precise proof for a precise statement. But this is rather a general feeling. So I'm not talking about this is not proved. Okay. But when you decrease R to an equiarea, so that the nonlinearity has an equiarea, becomes equiarea nonlinearity like this one, it seems that it's possible that transition layers can be generated in this form. And this would relate to the previous case by Mimura and his collaborators. Except there's a slight inconsistency. That is, well, I shouldn't say inconsistency. There's still something to be worked out. That is, here the rho 1, 2 over d1 is r0. R0 is certainly not any large value. Put it this way, not every large value will give us an equiarea nonlinearity like this. But, of course, here we do have a zeta that is at our disposal. Zeta is part of the solution, too. So there's some flexibility you can put in here. But how to make everything work, the two approaches agree, that is one question that we still don't know how to answer. But I think it's possible, but we don't know how to answer. Anyway, that's the connection to the transition layer. All right, so let me put this back on one here. All right. Okay, so I really run out of time. Let me just try to give you one more existence theorem before I go into the next category. So again, about existence for one, that's for this one. Okay, so we can prove that in the strong case, there's a similar thing, but in the weak case, this is certainly another subcase of the weak case. I will sum up those things later. But for the moment, you know, we have, now for the weak case, we have two subcases we can do. But in any case, again, if rho 1, 2 is large, d2 is small, d2 has to be small, then the original system has a non-constant positive solution. That goes to this one. Well, this is a Spikelier solution of 1. That's a Spikelier solution of 1 the graph that was shown earlier. All right. So, again, let me talk a little bit about a proof, the approach of the proof, rather, that is the Spikelier's for one, so I really should leave this one on instead. One. Okay. So you make a guess. We guess, well, first of all, we know this one has a solution, U star V star, right? That's a trivial solution, constant solution. And we also know that with our spike layers, U should be close to U star, V should be close to V star. So we make a guess that the zeta should be close to U star times V star. So let's say the simplest case, let's just worry about this equation first, forget about the integral constraint. Then we set U star, zeta to be U star times V star, and W to be V star minus phi. And plug that into the equation here, we get an equation of this kind. Now, if everything works out well, we will have a solution, we will have an equation of this kind. D2 is epsilon squared. As long as this coefficient is positive, we can write it as, we can normalize it so that it becomes negative 1, and so on and so forth. And this is, again, the equation we saw yesterday, where Tang Feng is going to talk about next week. So every time you obtain a theorem, a new theorem about this one, about the theorem, automatically that one will have a consequence back on this equation, and therefore will have a consequence on this one as well. So this becomes this is really the building block of this of these things. All right. So what are the conditions? So when do we have? When will we have that coefficient being positive? That's this one. So you see, that's the one. So this is one of them. Now, also we will need W to be positive. That means the maximum phi is less than V star. That's this one. And that means this is the case. You see, this certainly implies that. And this is the weak case. That's the weak case. This is the strong case. This is the strong case. So either weak or strong, the approach works well for both. All right. But of course, this is not everything yet, because as I said, this is only we only make a guess, get an approximate solution, because the integral constraint is not going to be satisfied by zeta equals u star v star. So you need to work a little bit more. You set zeta to be u star v star plus epsilon, and w to be v star plus delta, which depends on epsilon, minus phi. And plug in, and it's a little complicated, but you can work it out. So that's that. Now I want to go back to the shadow system one. It turns out that the shadow system one, that's this one, we can know just about everything. Well, not quite, but almost everything. In some cases, we know, again, just about everything. Let me take an example. Oh, this time I take the example to be strong case. The weak case is the same. Similar, anyway. So now I take A to be 4, B to be 1, C to be 6. Just say it's that. And basically, this is A1, A2, sorry. This is A1, B1, C1. I will take A2, B2, C2, A2, B2, C2 to be 1. Identically 1. They all 1. Then this one becomes that. And if I look at the special case, omega 0, 1, dimension 1, then the existence and non-existence for 1 is completely understood. That is, if D2 is between 0 and 1 over pi squared, then there's a non-constant solution. Actually, the solution is strictly increasing in 0, 1. And for D2 bigger than or equal to 1 over pi squared, then this one doesn't have any non-trivial solution. Then, of course, doesn't have any solution that is strictly increasing. So the existence is completely settled. The asymptotic behavior is also fairly well understood. Here. The asymptotic behavior basically says that as D2 goes to 0, as D2 goes to 0, W goes to this one. That's the V. And as D2 goes to 0, a zeta over W goes to this one. Well, I guess I wrote tau over W. That was a typo. Sorry. So this is the one we talked about. And as D2 goes to 1 over pi squared, then W goes to 0, because that's V, right? It's the same as V. That goes to 0, well, A plus B minus A times sine squared theta, that goes to 0, and zeta goes to 0. However, zeta over W, that's U, zeta over W, remains as a large amplitude solution. That becomes this one. So, uh, So, of course, one can ask, I will talk about a proof a little bit on this one later, but it turns out that one can have a pretty good understanding of these things. So I will put up give an overview of these kind of things. So this is the system we're talking about, and I will plot the existence and non-existence range according to D2 and A. This is B, this is C. So the non-existence range is colored by red. So this is red. The existence range, this simply says if D2 and if A and D2, this point, this ordered pair, lies in this red region, no existence, no non-trivial existence. Now this is the existence. If A and D2 lies in the blue region, then there is existence. You see there's a small triangle here that we don't know the answer. And the previous case, 416, lies here, somewhere here. All right. So that's basically the shadow system, the existence. I said about the behavior of the solution. I talked about the behavior of the solution once, and that's the qualitative behavior. But again, I wrote down the theorem down there. That looks complicated, but let me draw pictures for you so that you don't have to really read that. The picture is fairly simple. That is, in this range, if A is in this range, that's this picture. The graph of the solution will look like this one. That's the one we talked about earlier in 416, for instance, in that case, strong case. Now, if A is large enough, A is in this range, then actually W0 will go to 0 as epsilon goes to 0. Then the solution will look like this one. And you can see that the solution approaches to most part of the domain, a quarter and three quarters. That's independent of ABC. That depends only on A2, B2, C2. Independent of A1, B1, C1. So that's very different from this case. This case, U star, V star, of course, depends on A1, B1, C1. So this is actually it's very different from that one. Next week, I think, Professor Yutsutani will talk about this kind of thing and will give you the numerical simulations. We'll talk about the proofs of these things and the various other things. So I will not waste more time. I will not spend more time on this one now. Let me now go on to the next. Let me return to the existence theorem. So let's take this one off and return to the existence theorem. Remember, our goal originally was to use this use cross diffusion to generate patterns. So let's look at what we have done. Well, what we have done, so this is for the summary for the existence. Again, we didn't talk about the strong case. Let's just concentrate on the weak case here. All right? We know that in this range, we had an existence theorem by degree theoretic argument. And in this range, we had an existence by construction. Now, if we reverse row 1, 2, and row 2, 1, we get a different range, and so on and so forth. But if we, let me plot that on a picture like this, on a graph like this. So this is the weak competition, B bigger than A bigger than C. And I divide this one into three cases. But at this point, it's not necessary. They all are the same. In this range, it's degree theoretic argument. And this range is construction, spike layer construction. Now, if we reverse the role of row 1, 2, and row 2, 1, just from the point of view to generate patterns, then we're going to cover also the other end here. So the blue one represents row 2, 1 being large. So if row 2, 1 being large, we will cover this range like that if B is not so much larger than C. Well, even in this case, we still cover that. But if B is very large, bigger than 9C, then there's a gap. For A lies in this range, we have no existence. So with this gap there, we were a little bit puzzled how to generate patterns when A lies in that range. So I will put this one on. One way, at least, we found was to create patterns in this very weak competition case by introducing a third species competing at an appropriate level. And for example, this would be one remedy for that. That is to say, originally we have a thing like that, which we don't know if we're going to have non-trivial patterns, we're going to have patterns introduced. So let's just look at this one. But if we compete it, if we introduce the third species with A3, C13, C23 picked appropriately, and alpha beta picked appropriately, then we're going to have solutions of this, non-trivial patterns of this one. And this is something that Salome Martinez will be talking about, I suppose, next week a little bit. And she will also talk about the periodic solutions of the 3x3 generated in the 3x3 system, a periodic solution of this kind. So again, here, basically, the idea is that we have three species, so we pick them in a cyclic way. Row 1, 2, this is row 2, 3, but it's an R times row 1, 2. So we express that as a multiple of row 1, 2. And this is row 3, 1, that's S row 1, 2. And you pick R and S appropriately, and some periodic solutions can be worked out this way. So, anyway, so 3x3 systems is, of course, far more complicated. Even ODE, this is well-known work of Mary Lou Zeman on ODE. There are hundreds of cases that she had classified. Anyway, it's very complicated there, even for ODE, but for some simple PDE like this form, in this form, actually you can generate periodic solutions quite I shouldn't say quite easily, because the computation here is also quite hard, but at least at a conceptual level, it is not that hard. The species 2 pushes 1 away, while 3 pushes 2 away, and 1 turns around, pushes 3 away, and that becomes a cycle. But that's the basic idea involved. So that's that. Now, at the end, I have maybe 4 or 5 minutes. I will talk a little bit about the dynamics, because I have so far, well, except the periodic solutions, I have not really talked about much about the dynamics of these things. So I thought I would touch upon that just a little bit. So parabolic system. Now, the local, you see, you notice that this is a, I should take this one out. The system is a The system is it's strongly coupled in the highest order term as well. So even the local existence is not a trivial matter, I think. And indeed, the local existence was done in a series of papers by Amann during 1989 and 1993. I think the proof is fine. There's the complete detail of the proofs, to the best of my knowledge, will be published in his book. He has a 3-volume book. And that's not a joke, you know, that's true. And there's one very important estimate would appear in volume 3. I think the first we have two volumes already, but the third one is yet to come out, right? Is that right? Okay. That's my understanding anyway. So the third volume will contain this crucial, complicated estimate for the local existence. All right. Now for the global existence, of course that simply means if you look at special cases to this one, you will have global existence. So the first one was due to Kim for n equal 1, d1 equals d2. N equal 1, d1 equals d2. And then during for small cross diffusion coefficients, and Yagi for the case n equal 2, where small cross diffusion or large self diffusion, that is to say, if rho 1-1, rho 2-2 dominates rho 2-1 and rho 1-2, then one has global existence. And we also proved that for n equal 2, if one of the cross diffusion is 0, then we can have global existence. Now, but these are for global existence. There's no connection between the global existence and the steady state was no conclusion so far in those papers. So the first one was done this year to relate time-dependent solutions to steady states a priori estimates independent of t seem essential, although that may not be sufficient. So I will explain that a little bit more. This is Song Ah Shim's thesis. And so let's look at that using the last minute or two. Okay. So this is what she did. This is the parabolic problem. That's the same as this one, essentially. With rho 1-1 and rho 2-2, there helps things, by the way. This is the hard part, anyway. So there's a constant independent of u0, v0, of course, and a t. T depends on u0, v0, such that eventually the solution of the parabolic equation goes into is bounded by m. And if d is bigger than or equal to 1, that is d. You see, I wrote d1, d2 to be the same. That's the same as Kim's result. Well, the same as Kim's setting. So if m is independent of d, if d is bigger than or equal to 1. So this has a consequence. You may think the consequence is trivial. I think it appears to be trivial. But nonetheless, it's a first step. It basically says in the weak competition case, if the diffusion coefficient is large enough, then the solution goes to the trivial state. So that's the first step to clear off the way, say, well, at least we know what happens, what will happen trivially. So his method, her method is, see, we do not discriminate. So I use he for everyone. Anyway, her method is that she follows closely Kim's setup. So instead of two equations, they set up another one. That's zeta equals u minus v. And write down the equation for zeta.
becomes a 3x3 system, and then she was able to derive inequality of this kind and use Gagliardo-Nirenberg's inequality, plays an important role in doing this to obtain those results. So that's basically it for my two lectures. I do want to say one thing at the end about the cross diffusion. No. So one may ask, so how exactly essential is it to have cross diffusion? Well, the answer is may not be so essential. I don't know. I think, for instance, in Dr. Ninomiya's talk next week, he will talk about how to represent a cross diffusion system of lower rank, say 2x2, by a diffusion system of higher rank, say 9x9. So I think the message is essentially that in dealing with cross diffusion, if you're willing to increase the number of unknowns and equations, you can put it into the form of a diffusion system. You may have to use many variables, but you can probably do that. Anyway, so that's what Ninomiya is going to talk about next week. And with that, I think I will close this talk, and I want to thank you for your attention.
Questions?
Very clear. Very good.
Sorry. There are no more questions.
All right, thank you.